Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, welcome along to Writer's Routine. This week, we're chatting to Mark Watson, a comedian, long-distance-going comedian as well, Edinburgh Fringe hero, also a pretty prolific and successful writer. He's just released Contacts, which is his sixth novel. It's all about how technology and social media can actually help improve our lives and relationships, which, if you think about it, is absolutely in direct contrast to a lot of other books that you're told to read at the moment. It's welcome, it's refreshing, and it's a nice eye-opener in what actually our phones and social media can do. Now, we talk about why he likes the bustle and the busyness when he's writing, also how joke-telling and storytelling are both similar and also completely different, and we find out how for him, unlike many authors that we've heard from, the act of writing is actually what keeps him going.
I genuinely love it. I love the craft of it. I don't find it a grind to do it. I think, and again, I'm not saying I'm any better at it. There are definitely loads of writers that are much better than me that find it harder, probably because they're better, because they think more. But to me, it's a genuine, like, if I wasn't doing it, publishing books and so on, I'd still be doing it as a hobby. It's always been one of my favorite activities regardless. So I look forward to writing every day in the same way that you might look forward to, like, going for a run or something.
There's more on the way with Mark Watson in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along to Writer's Routine. My name's Dan Simpson. Thank you so much for listening. This is the podcast where we take a look inside an author's working day to see how they get that mysterious kind of magic done. What are you reading at the moment, by the way? We're so focused on the work and the nitty-gritty of how you actually write that we never really talk about what you are reading when you have written. My resolution for 2020 was to read 20 books. Now, don't judge me about that. I'm a desperately slow reader. And if you think as well, for a lot of the time, for most of these interviews, I'm reading about half, two-thirds of a book for an author that I'm chatting to, and they don't count towards the final list. So I've done all of those. I've also done 18 for this year. 18's okay, I think. I tend to go through mad rushes and slow burns depending on what I'm reading. How are you getting on? Like, for instance, during lockdown one here in the UK, I became absolutely obsessed with Malcolm Gladwell. Outliers. Have you read Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell? One of the best non-fiction books I think I've ever read. Absolutely burned through those. Then after that, I read Wolf Hall, which is fantastic. Hilary Mantel. It is a little bit of a slow burner, though. You take time poring over all the words and how it's formatted. So that took me a while. Now I'm on my 18th, which is P.G. Woodhouse. Can't go wrong with P.G. Woodhouse. I think during a second lockdown in the middle of autumn, there's just some magic in there. I'm reading Laughing Gas. So that's me. I mean, how have you done? How has your book reading gone this year? If you've done well, I hope it's included some of the guests that we've chatted to on the show. Maybe you'll put the new one from Mark Watson on the list. He's on the show this week. He's a brilliantly successful comedian known for marathon shows where he's on stage for like 24, 48 hours at a time, raising loads of cash for charity as well. His new book is Contact. It's all about James Chilton, who sends a message to his contact book on his phone saying that he plans to end his life. Then he sticks it on airplane mode. And then for those people he's texted, they have to work together to find out what's happened. It's one man's last journey, 158 chances to save his life. It was inspired by his own mental health addictions, drinking too much, his marriage coming apart too. Now, he believes that digital communication, tech and social media, they were his salvation during that time. Now, we talk about this and also how the idea came to him pretty much fully formed, how much he plans as well, why he likes to give the story a good going over at first. You can also hear about his staunch font opinions. We'll begin to that at the moment. I've been doing this podcast for like 3 years, and only in the last couple of months have I realised the trove of joy that is someone's font opinions. We hear about that, why he mixes them up between and sometimes even during his books. And we also talk about writing when you're touring on the road. So that's on the way. Let's get into it straight off then with Mark Watson and what he sees around him in the place where he sits down to write.
Well, I'm fortunate to have, this is a rented place, but it's quite a large house, and I've got a little attic basically that I write in, which means that I can, as we speak, I'm looking out over people's gardens, the gardens of my next door neighbours, if that doesn't sound too creepy. And I've always liked to, where possible, write in high up spots. I like looking out over, you know, cities out of a hotel room, for example, or I like seeing stuff happening, basically. A lot of writers seem to, when I read about them, they seem to like to sort of shut themselves away. They'll often retreat into nature or, you know, isolate themselves. But I kind of enjoy being able to see activity. I find that more stimulating mentally for writing.
Getting quite introspective early on. Why do you think that is? As a comedian, you're always in front of people performing like that, and you do, you know, ludicrously long 24-hour shows where you're seeing people being stimulated like that all the time. Why do you think that's what gets you going?
Yeah, well, good question. It might just be force of habit. It might just be that as a stand-up, I'm so used to being around activity and life, as you say, that's what comes naturally to me. But I think it's more than that. I think I've always been kind of a city dweller. I'm not much of a sort of nature appreciator compared with some people. I think what gets my brain active is other people, what they do, I can't see anyone at the moment. There's not one person out in the garden doing something fun for me to spark off, which is quite selfish of them, really. No one's bouncing on a trampoline, no one's shoveling leaves, but just in general, these tiny rituals that make up people's lives, I think they're what make me feel alive. I just enjoy the feeling of being part of a huge kind of puzzle of other humans. So it's something to do with that, I think. It's something to do with enjoying being part of a game. Whereas if, you know, when I'm in a hotel room or something, I can see, it's a bit different these days because no one can really go anywhere, but in normal times, if I can see trains going in and out of stations or just the bustle of human routines, that makes me really happy. Whereas just looking at a mountain or something, I'd think, well, that's very pretty, but somehow wouldn't get my brain going in the same way, I think.
Now, that's looking outside of your window. Take us into the room, also an attic, which seems, as a writer, quite a romantic place to get your words down. Tell us what you can see around you. What have you got on the walls? What's kind of sparking inspiration there?
Yeah, it is quite romantic. It's not the way I necessarily planned it. It just happens that this place has this upstairs room. I mean, it does serve as a spare room if visitors are here, but obviously I see it as my writing space, and now we can't have visitors anymore. I've reclaimed it, almost as if I engineered this whole thing. I don't have a lot of stuff on the walls. There's a picture of the Clifton Suspension Bridge in Bristol, which is where I come from. There are a couple of other framed sort of pictures and stuff. And then there's a handful of bits and pieces one or two books, but quite a minimal number, one or two papers. I keep it fairly sparse here. I would find it hard to write surrounded by hundreds of other books. Sometimes, again, I'm always interested in what other writers get up to, especially more kind of distinguished ones. And often you see a picture of their study and it's just wall-to-wall volumes. But I think I'd find it slightly intimidating if every time I stopped between sentences, I glanced up to see all the books people had already finished off.
Are there any of your own works there that let you know that you can do this when perhaps you're at a low ebb?
It's interesting you should say that. I do currently have my new book in front of me just because it worked out that way. I had to, I think I was doing chatting about it and I had it to hand so I could read a passage or something last week. But that's just a fluke because it came out recently. Normally I don't have other books within sight. I think it might be, I don't know if it's deliberate or not, but I sort of feel like, I mean, in a lot of ways, it would make complete sense to do that, just as you said, to have them there as a kind of confidence boost. But I tend to, once I'm starting a new book or working on anything, I tend to try and forget what's gone before, basically. The books, it's satisfying to have the books out there, but I don't really draw on that thought. So I think, yeah, weird as it might sound, I kind of distance myself mentally from the books as soon as they're out. So generally, I don't write with any room. I do have them all. I'm not that Spartan. I've got them all on a shelf downstairs all together, but it's quite a high shelf, so people can't necessarily see them. I think it'd be weird if you walked into my house and immediately saw like a shrine to my own work.
Yeah, I have been to some writers' houses though, and you would not be surprised at how often that is actually the case.
Yeah, I find it satisfying to have them all. I've also got a few foreign language copies for the couple of books that are a bit, like, it's nice to have them as objects, and I do take some satisfaction and pride from looking at them, without doubt. But I don't want that to be in other people's faces. You have to look quite hard to find them if you're a visitor.
Now, this might seem incredibly niche and geeky to you, but we like to know what you're writing on. So on the desk, are you laptop? What software are you using? Go ahead with all that.
Well, this is a Mac that I'm talking to, and this is what I always write on. Until a few years ago, I was a PC person. I made the switch to Mac because loads of people kept telling me to, and they were right, I think. I've always worked on a computer, writing wise, since I was a student, basically because, well, among other things, I'm left-handed and my pen grip is really torturous. It's horrible to watch and it's quite painful to actually do it. Exams at university used to absolutely kill me. So for a long time, I've been, you know, some people, some writers will talk about the purity of writing everything longhand and stuff like that, but that's never appealed to me because it takes me absolutely ages to do that. I would only ever have got one novel finished in my life if I had to write it out by hand, I think. Whereas typing, I learned to do quite quickly, quite early. So I don't really hold with the idea that typing stuff out is in some way less pure or poetic than writing. I think whatever allows you to express yourself as well as possible is the way to do it. This said, though, I suppose I'm old-fashioned in some ways because I use Word, and most writers talk about more up-to-date writing packet. They've all got packages that are, like Scrivener, is it? Or
it's Scrivener, and I'll emphasise that because they've sponsored the show many times.
There you go. Oh, absolutely nothing against Scrivener. But, I just have never progressed beyond Word because I suppose quite simply because I know exactly how to use it. I know everything that it does. And I don't think that I have any needs beyond that. And I am quite a stick in the mud. I sometimes with scripts and stuff, I've occasionally do screenwriting. For that, I do use Final Draft, which is a great tool, which I taught myself to use laboriously. But this is the thing, I'm quite bad at learning to use new stuff. So if I was to use something else other than Word and it took me a while to master it, I'd quickly become grumpy about it.
And getting even nicher, just lastly on your writing space, what are your opinions on font, Mark?
I do have some opinions on this, actually. I tend to use a different font every time. I've got a couple of favourites, there's one called Georgia, I think. Quite fond of Garamond. But I basically, it's quite interesting, the font thing. I tend to, firstly, use a different font every time because somehow that makes it feel more like a different project to me, like a new start. But also, I'll quite often change the font midway through a piece of work because someone told me that doing that would enable me to see things more freshly. And I think it's true. It's a tip that I don't have many tips that I pass on to writers because I don't generally feel like I know what I'm doing. But I do think it's true that if you switch font and read again, you will spot a surprising number of stuff that passed you by before.
I never used to ask questions about font. And then a few months ago, a couple of listeners got in touch. And I had no idea kind of the treasure trove of quirky tips that asking about fonts would give me like that.
It's interesting. I think it is much more important than you'd think, really, because you are staring at it for absolutely months. And something else I've heard people say is that you should write in the ugliest font you can, write in something that looks like rubbish, because then you won't be seduced by the look of it. You know, the failings of the writing will sort of stare you in the face. And I think that probably is a good tip as well. But I haven't got the stomach to be looking at a crap font for like a year. On a day when I'm not performing, touring or something, in normal circumstances, things were a lot smoother. But a lot of my life is taken up with touring. So it can go one of two ways. If I'm, let's say I have a day where all I have to do is write, what I'll tend to do is set kind of a big chunk of time. Normally in the afternoon, I've always enjoyed working late afternoon into evening, getting other stuff done early in the day that needs doing, clearing that mental space, and then going, sort of shutting myself away and going for it with a glass of wine. Normally, once I'm writing, I like to write in quite long, intense periods. And in normal times, in years gone by, certainly with this book that I've just written and with the past couple, I wrote quite long chunks of it in the night, in the middle of the night, because that's been a productive time for me. If I'm on tour, though, if I'm gigging somewhere, things are different. Then I have to get myself together and perhaps write on a train or on the road, even if I'm in a tour vehicle. So, you know, I've got my kind of luxurious writer's routine and then a kind of pragmatic one, which I am also able to follow. I love to have the luxury of just sitting at my desk for hours at a time, but just because of my lifestyle, I've also learned to write almost anywhere. And then there's a third answer, which is these days with the pandemic and everything, and hopefully people are listening to this in happier times, or some people. But yeah, in these times, I've almost flipped, and I nowadays get up very early to write, because that again is just enforced. There's only a couple of hours at the start of the day when I'm likely to have complete freedom and quiet. So that's when I do it. So basically, I'll go wherever the piece is writing-wise.
What do you... there's a lot going on there, a lot of different things, the three different times of the day that you find yourself writing. How do you differentiate those yourself? Do you find that you're better at one time of the day, that even though you are able to write on trains when you're gigging, it's not as perfect as you would like it? How do you sort those out?
No, it's never as perfect. It's never perfect. That the closest I get to perfect writing conditions on a train is if I'm lucky enough to be going somewhere like Glasgow or even Newcastle. Like a 3 to 4 hour train journey is long enough to properly immerse yourself, I think. But that is always suboptimal. And then I'll tend to top up by trying to do some time writing in the hotel or wherever I'm staying. My ideal conditions definitely are to be a day when I get up and all that I have to accomplish is just write for absolutely ages is blissful to me. I never worry about motivation. I never struggle to get going. Well, I can struggle. Every writer struggles to get going, but not because of motivation or reluctance in my case. I think, you know, my time has been quite brutally short for ages, for years really, because of having kids and because of having another career. So some people will say, oh, I'd love to write, but I just stare at the blank page and it's too off-putting, or sometimes I just don't feel like it. I don't really feel as if I have that option. If there is a window to write in, I just have to do it. And that might sound a bit sort of industrial and joyless, but I think it's not a bad instinct to be in. If, again, doesn't mean I always get anything done. Sometimes I'll write and it'll be rubbish or I'm stuck. But I always, if I can write, I will write. It's basically the closest I've got to a rule.
You spoke about immersion earlier, immersing yourself in your work. Is there anything that, although, as you've just said, you are very good at just getting into it, but is there anything that does really help you get in the zone, just really hone in on you, no matter where you are? Is there something that you can do to just switch into that mode?
Well, good question. So again, people talk about music a lot, and a lot of people don't write with music because they find that it disrupts the rhythm of the prose, maybe, you know, or they can't concentrate. Some people read aloud as they're writing, so then impossible to also have music on. But I'm quite a big advocate of having music on to write. I think that actually connects me with my sort of writing self, if I can use that phrase. It can't just be anything. It can't be distracting. It's got to be music that I know well enough already that I'm not consciously engaging with it. If I can pick the right stuff that my brain already recognizes and isn't focusing on, then for whatever reason, that does seem to work for me. I do quite a lot of writing in, like, with headphones on, with quite loud music in my ears, and it doesn't, I don't find that a distraction. I find it sort of a stimulus.
Any particular music?
Well, what I'll often do is get a couple of albums that I know really, really well, and then play them heavily during. Like there was an album by, there's a band called Grizzly Bear, who, for whatever reason, like two or three of their albums have done the trick for me. I don't, it's something to do with the type of music, which is kind of quite orchestral, rich and orchestral, but not too heavy, not too, well, for whatever reason, there are a few key bands that I'm able to kind of mainline their music semi-consciously, and that seems to put me into a sort of mode where I myself become more creative. I don't know why it is. If I was to read someone else's writing, I don't think that would put me in the mood to write. I think I'd find it obstructed me or inhibited me in some way. Something about tapping into other people's creative brains, but in unintrusive ways, seems to work for me. I wouldn't be able to have the radio on. I can't write with chatter in the background, but music, if it's the right music, it can sort of carry you along, I think.
In happier times, when you have got a lot of different stuff on, how many days do you tend to write a week?
It's a shame how often we need to use phrases like "in happier times" these days.
Isn't it? I know.
Almost every other sentence. So many caveats these days. In a dream situation, I'll write almost every day. I'm not great at relaxing. I find if I've got a book on, my brain is always circling back to it. Even if I've got in trouble before for going on holiday or on weekend breaks and still not being able to really zone out. I'd happily write every day if I could. And of course you can't, I mean, it's not very good. It doesn't make you a good person to live with. So I don't do that, but I genuinely love it. I love the craft of it. I don't find it a grind to do it. I think, and again, I'm not saying I'm any better at it. There are definitely loads of writers that are much better than me that find it harder, probably because they're better, because they think more. But to me, it's a genuine, like if I wasn't doing it, publishing books and so on, I'd still be doing it as a hobby. It's always been one of my favorite activities regardless. So I look forward to writing every day in the same way that you might look forward to like going for a run or something.
It's interesting because there is a confliction there almost, in that you love writing. You love writing, you know, almost romantically, in if you're able to have the whole day. But also you mentioned that it's quite industrial the way you work. It's this need to just write, let's get down, let's get those words out. What is the aim for how much you're working on a day? Have you got a word count in mind? Is there a specific format in which you do it?
Well, I never set an actual word count. I'd never say 500 or 1,000 words or anything, because I feel like then you are just, you know, trying to run the clock down sort of thing. Then you are just trying to pile up words for the sake of it, or I would be anyway. But I do take a certain satisfaction in passing those milestones. Like I don't check how much I've written as I'm going along very often, but if I have a break and have a look and I've done like 1,500 words, whatever it might be, I do feel like, okay, something substantial has been achieved here. So I suppose what I'm saying is I don't have actual targets, but I do kind of congratulate myself if there's a large word count on the board. And of course, again, sometimes that might all be rubbish. That sometimes you'll write one good sentence and that's all you actually end up with, especially with a novel. Loads of times with a novel, so little of what was your first draft actually remains word for word. I remember once I went on a flight to, must have been flying to Australia, but I remember the first leg was via Hong Kong anyway, and I got out of Hong Kong, I'd written something like 8,000 words, some insane tally like that, because I'd just been writing from takeoff to landing. And I was absolutely delighted with myself. But if you actually looked at that writing and how much of it got into the final book, I bet it was almost none of it. I think sometimes with a novel, it's the psychological momentum that's important, feeling like you're pushing the story forward, pushing yourself forward, even if you know as you're getting it down that it might not be perfect by any means, that you might not actually use it. I think that's why I always say to writers, just keep putting words on paper, even if you're stuck, even if it doesn't seem like it's going well, write something. Because the process of that is still dragging you through this project. It's still worth doing, even if you don't think it's going well. Whereas stopping will not get you anywhere. It will just discourage you, obviously. Once you lose momentum in a long project, very, very hard to get it back.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
We'll get back to it with more from Mark in just a sec. Very quickly before then, a little reminder, if you enjoy these podcasts, if you've just found us maybe, and you've got like 130-odd episodes worth of tips and advice from some of the best authors around that's really helping you out. If you think they're worth a few quid, a couple of dollars a month, you can help us out with that. Sign up, support us at patreon.com/writersroutine. That's how you help the show. You can get thanks on there. You can get a little bit of merch sent your way. You can even find a way for your book to sponsor this show. Doesn't need to be a lot. I'll be honest, a little bit awkward even chatting about it. I'm British after all. But if you do love what we do, if you want to see us carry on bringing you these chats with the best authors around as often as we can, you can help that happen by supporting us over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back to it then with this week's guest on Writers Routine, Mark Watson, talking about his brand new book, Contacts. In this half, we talk about how much he plots and why he's afraid of spreadsheets. We also chat about tone, how he balances the lightness of being a comic and perhaps the darkness of some of the subject matters. And we pick things up talking about the planning and how much an idea changes from beginning to end.
The idea for this book was kind of quite a neat, clean idea. So as soon as although it was still complicated to write, once I'd had the initial idea that it wasn't ever going to change enormously from first moment to last, whereas I've written books in the past where something was wrong with the initial idea or the plan that I started out with wasn't quite right, and so I think it's partly that, partly it's about discipline, but also some ideas are the two books I've written that were closest from first thought to execution were this one, Contact, and a book called 11 from years ago, and both of those were ideas that I still had a lot of work to do between first moment and final draft, but the central idea didn't change that much. Whereas if you have an idea that mutates a lot as you're going along, then I don't think it matters how many times you've done it before, you're still going to be wrestling with it a lot. So I think you do get better at it. But the fact is, when you're planning, and I do quite a lot of planning and plotting before I start, you still don't really know if that plan is going to stand up or if you're going to have to go, you know, rethink, start bits again, all that. So I think that affects it. I'd like to think I've got better at the process because it's been, as you say, a number of books and a number of years, but I still think each book is a case-by-case basis, basically. You don't know till you're in it if it's working or not.
We'll get to Contact in just a sec. I'm interested in you not writing to a limit each day, and some days you might not be able to get to write. How does that work when you are writing to a deadline, when you know that, okay, by November the 4th, you need to have done 80,000 words and you need to have handed that in. How does that work? How are you planning your time to make sure that you're ready to hand in then?
Well, it's very difficult. Everyone knows that writing to any sort of deadline is difficult, even if you're just talking about a 1,000-word article or something. With a novel, I think, you do need a sensitive editor. You need a sympathetic editor, because I don't think that you can obviously you do have to write to deadlines, and with a novel there will be times where it literally is a case of on November the 4th this is going in. But I guess if you've got a good editor, which is absolutely essential for writing a novel and for publishing one, I think you have to have a relationship where you can say, look, you can have it on November the 4th, but this bit won't be right, this bit needs changing, this bit, you know. I think it's pretty hard to, you know, much as I'm good at setting targets and, you know, working and having a routine and stuff like that, nonetheless, a novel is such a difficult beast, it does get away from you at times. Sometimes you have to accept you're behind where you wanted to be, and you're not going to resolve a problem today, you might not do it this week. So that's part of it, I think. I'm reasonably good at being disciplined and hitting goals, but I don't think novels ever cooperate with you that much. I think you have to accept that a book is going to mess with you and with your timelines quite a lot along the way, and you have to hope that whoever you're writing it for understands that. Luckily they will, because they'll have published loads of other authors who were also a shambles.
Now, I've been really excited to ask you this question, because I believe you are the first comedian who I've spoken to that's written a novel. Now, because I think you have to consider comedians one of the ultimate storytellers, in that they're able to get away, you know, a story, a joke in just a few lines, with a beginning, with a middle, with a good punchline. And I know that you spent a lot of time crafting that. What did writing jokes teach you about writing stories, full-length novels?
Well, it's interesting this, because you're right. Surprisingly, not many, to me it's surprising that not many of my fellow stand-ups write novels, are interested in it. Because I do think that the techniques are similar in a way. But they're almost two different crafts for me. I spend a lot of time on a novel honing, polishing, thinking, and most of what I do on stage is much more instinctive than that. I don't commit a lot to paper. I don't write routines out very much or jokes. I tend to just, I do have like bullet points or notes to work from, but I'm not very scripted as a stand-up. So they're kind of different disciplines. But one thing I certainly have learned is economy, I think, because as you say, with a stand-up routine, with a comedy show, you've got to get a story away pretty fast. You can't be messing about. You can only afford to include what is absolutely necessary for the thing to work. And sometimes when I'm reading a novel, I was talking about this with someone the other day, if you read a novel that lacks storytelling focus, you know, it might be very prettily written, but the story is slowly or uneconomically told, I do always think, come on, get on with it, in the same way that you might if you watch the stand-up rambling on stage. So I think that's one thing. I've learned from comedy that an audience requires you to hit certain points. That you can get there however you want, but you need to remain interesting. And I think that's quite a good precept for a novel. Any novel, you'll find there are passages where you're just drifting. You've slightly lost sight of your obligation to make it fun for the audience. And on stage, you can't do that. If it's not fun every minute, you'll know about it. So I suppose that's one thing I've learned. I've learned to be like quick and sharp, and I try to carry that into my writing so that people are never bored.
Now, without teaching a comedian anything, please, I ask you that because there's a brilliant video on YouTube. It's of Jerry Seinfeld. You think of his, what your comedy, what you will, but he's talking to the New York Times about how he writes jokes, and he shaves off syllables to make it as punchy and quick as possible. And it's absolutely fascinating. Well, listen, the new book market, it's Contacts, and you've already touched on the idea, but we kind of always get into books in the same way. So tell me about the moment when that first idea, how vivid it was for you, how it came into your head, how did it present itself?
Well, so the book is about a guy who threatens to end his life and sends a text announcing that to his whole phone book, which is why it's called Contacts, because, you know, all of his contacts receive it, people he knows very well and people he doesn't know. And it was something that happened to me years ago. I wasn't the sender, but I received a sort of desperate message from someone, which, because of the way it was framed, had obviously been sent to a whole phone book. And I, at the time, I helped out as best I could, like a lot of people did, and it was all right in the end. But it did stay in my head as I don't think I consciously logged it as a potential thing to write about. I did kind of come to think of it as a possible novel. It's something that I've done quite a lot in life is, and perhaps all writers do, filed away what seems like a good idea for a book, forgotten about it, and then it just kind of has its moment. So then, for whatever reason, a couple of years ago, this idea just forced its way back into my head, and it just seemed like the right thing to do. Most books I've had that I've written have come from an initial seed like that, but which I carried around for years without even being conscious of it. And then for whatever reason, a day comes when you think, oh, I remember that idea. This is now its time.
What then happens next? You said that you're quite a thorough plotter and planner, and you've already kind of lived that story then. If you kind of helped out your mate or whoever it was that sent this desperate text, you've already lived that. So how do you, when you have this new idea, when it comes back to you, what do you do next? What's the next stage in plotting and planning before you end up typing your first sentence?
Well, when the idea's resurfaced, I sort of ask myself proper questions about it. I think, all right, well, who is this character? What would actually happen here beyond the first 30 pages? I think a lot of the time, everyone will be familiar with this feeling of like, oh, that would make a novel. I could write a book about that. People say that about all sorts of stuff. And then what often stops, because almost anything sounds like a good, like you see someone in the street that's just dropped a load of shopping, someone else helps them, they shake hands, you think maybe they're gonna be friends. Like that's the seed of a novel, and you could see 10 of those a day. But what differentiates a good idea from a misleading idea is, does it have actual legs? What would happen next? So I tend to ask myself that. I think, okay, that's a great starting point for a book, but what would happen? You don't have to see every beat of the story, but you need to be able to convince yourself that you could tell yourself a version of this story, and you could sort of imagine how it would play out, even if you don't know how it'll end. So that's basically it for me. I try and sketch out as much of it as I can, even if it's completely wrong, just to convince myself that it has the legs that I think it does. And that process takes weeks sometimes. I don't have to have everything plotted, because I don't think you can do that, but I do like to feel that I've given the story a going over before I start trying to actually delve into it longhand. It's just notes. Yeah, I'm not disciplined enough to have a spreadsheet, and I also don't really know how spreadsheets work. I'm scared of them. If someone sends me a spreadsheet or an Excel file or something to look over as an attachment, I can do it, but I don't like it. So actually, I'll have notebooks. I like a big sort of A3 notebooks. I always buy the similar looking ones, normally lined like with the sort of paper you write on in school. Don't know why, but that seems to work for me. And I'll just write. What I like to do actually is break up a couple of pages into boxes, number them, and then see if I can move from one box to another. This is something that a sort of mentor and friend of mine called Philip taught me years ago. He's a theatre director rather than a writer, but his thing was that any story, you should be able to write what point number one is, and then what point number 20 or 30 is, the end, and then gradually start plotting the points in between. And again, this is a very vague process. You might well not visit half those points, but it's just, again, just to sort of convince yourself that there is a possible path between what you think is the start and what you think is the end. And again, I'll spend ages doing that, because I like to go in to the proper writing feeling that I haven't worked out all the, you can't work out all the plots, all the little incidents, all the stuff that makes up the novel, but if you can draw yourself a bit of a map, then I think to me that's quite a useful start. If I didn't go in like that, I think I'd worry that after 50 pages I would have just like driven into a cul-de-sac.
With that path then, how much of it do you tend to, so are you, if it was a path that you're walking, you know, your lockdown walk that you're allowed to do for an hour a day or whatever, you know where you're starting. Do you know exactly where you're going to end up? Do you know how this book is going to finish? Do you know the midpoint?
To be honest, no. I was still trying to work out what I thought the end of this book should be, very close to the end. Partly because this is the thing, you can certainly plot the start. You can plot yourself all the way to the middle with a sort of roadmap. But, you know, people mystify the process sometimes and say, oh, the characters start to talk for themselves, the characters take a life of their own on. And, you know, it can sound really silly when people talk like that. But it is true that by the time you've written 50,000 words of a book, it has taken on a certain momentum which you didn't anticipate. So it's not quite as simple as thinking, oh, I know what the end will be. Because 6 months from that point, you think, oh, I know what the end was, but that doesn't quite make sense now that I understand who the characters are. So I think, you know, some writers say that they start with the end and work backwards, basically. So they always know where they want to get to. And it's just a matter of working out how to do that. And that fascinates me, because I suppose that is optimal, because then you always know what your target is. But I've never written a book like that. I've never known 100% what the end is, because I think, for me, I can't know that until I know like where the book wants to go.
What's interesting is how the premise of your plot, anyway, that what I was sent through, seems to be a kind of almost a direct contrast of what a lot of people are saying about tech and social media at the moment.
Yeah, it is.
So we're being told that screen time is bad, that, you know, social media has made us more antisocial than ever. But this book is about how digital communication is a salvation. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah. So in the book, everyone, his suicidal character's phone is off. It's switched to flight mode, actually. So people can't contact him. And so they have to contact one another and try and form a sort of alliance to help him. And just in the past few weeks, there's been a real life incident like this where a guy put a thing on Twitter saying, "I'm doing really badly here. Can anyone just say hi?" Basically, there was no more to it than that. But it worked. Loads of people that he never knew like just jumped on in like what they call a pile-on on Twitter, but the opposite, a benign pile-on. And, you know, this kind of thing does happen quite a bit. You know, good uses of social media, of the internet, and certainly can happen. And, yeah, basically, you're right. I'm interested in playing with the idea that it doesn't have to be a bad thing. You know, people tend to assume that the fact we're all on screens and devices the whole time, it automatically makes us more separated and atomized as a society. And I agree that can happen. But this book is about what would happen if we use these devices for good. What about if we started seeing technology as something to help us be in contact with each other more? And what could we then do?
I wanted to ask you very quickly about tone, because this is clearly, by its very nature, it's slightly dark, pessimistic at times novel. You know, it's quite ominous. Whereas you're a comedian who's known for, you know, being funny, being up. How did you go about getting the voice right for your narrative?
Well, it's not easy, because you do find yourself talking like a comedian on the page if you're not careful. And as you say, that's not quite the right tone for this. But at the same time, there is some lightness. The tone is something that you gradually work on. You build layer on layer. I always try and not sound like the Mark Watson who's a stand-up too much, even though that might be what people are expecting from the book, because I want it to sound different from that, and I want to be able to unpack different themes. This is an opportunity, this book, because of the subject matter, there's an opportunity to go quite deep but also be quite light. So hopefully I've managed to straddle those things. That's what I always try and do, basically. Take on big stuff, as big as my brain can within its realm, but still have the lightness of touch of a comedian.
And that is it for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Mark Watson for coming on the show. If you like what you heard, you can grab a copy of his new book, Contact, his sixth novel. I've got a link for you in the episode notes wherever you're listening, and over at writersroutine.com as well. While you're there, you can get in touch with the show. Drop us a line on the contact form, let us know what you're thinking. You can also do that by leaving a review over on Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to help the show, leaving a review is a brilliant way to do it. You can also support us over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Just a little goes a phenomenally long way on there, I promise. Now, next week, we're chatting to Sarita Domingo all about her new audiobook, Romance, If I Don't Have You. It's a brilliant fun chat, a real giggle, that one. So make sure you're listening. Back next week with Sarita Domingo on Writer's Routine. I'll see you then. Bye.